This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, May 27th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker.
So poverty and the impact of poverty on our children and dealing with issues of institutional racism and sexism and classism and xenophobia and everything that keeps the majority of us oppressed is what we designed this campaign to fight against. So tonight, as we celebrate, we don't just celebrate me as an individual. We celebrate this movement, a movement designed to push back against a system that's literally killing us. It's killing black and brown bodies disproportionately, but it's killing all of us.
Last year, Jamal Bowman defeated 16-term incumbent Elliot Engel in the Democratic primary for the seat in New York's 16th Congressional District. Bowman, a former middle school principal and Black Lives Matter supporter, is part of a progressive push within the Democratic Party, a movement whose figureheads include Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Many credit the movement with reshaping the policy priorities of the Biden administration and helping Biden pass ambitious, progressive legislation in his first months in office. Others, including moderates in the party, are concerned that a continuing shift left could alienate some voters and put the Democrats' slim congressional majorities at risk. Andrew Marantz, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss the progressive movement and the groups that have helped it gain traction in Washington, and whether the country is experiencing a political realignment. Hi, Andrew. Always good to have you on the program.
Hey, thank you, Dorothy. Yeah, I'm excited to, there's a lot here.
There sure is. So let's dive in. It is so hard to wrap your head around what's going on in the Democratic Party. Some Democrats say that progressivism is the future. Others say it's a death wish. Joe Biden was elected as a moderate Democrat, but he's pursuing the most progressive agenda in many decades. We've got converging crises of climate change, the pandemic, income inequality, the fight for racial justice, and countless ideas about how to deal with them. So you went looking for a way to think about all of this and ended up writing about a group of young activists called the Justice Democrats and a few other groups as well. Tell me about them.
Yeah, so they kind of operate in tandem. You know, the Justice Democrats is a group that has been called sometimes pejoratively the Tea Party of the left. But some of the people in my piece were kind of embracing that label and basically saying, you know, we obviously don't agree with the Tea Party's ideology or obstructionist anti-government program. But if by Tea Party of the left, you mean people who use primary elections as a lever to get a major political party to implement their agenda, then yeah, we're actually fine with that. And, you know, of course, none of these transformations is ever total or instantaneous. But I think what you've seen over the last few years is that groups like Justice Democrats that, you know, really recruited and you know, ran people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush and many others, they are in tandem with groups like Sunrise, the Climate Action Group, and Data for Progress, which is a progressive polling group. There's this kind of cohort of young activists that is, they are a force in politics in a way that they weren't, you know, I think until very recently. You know, they weren't during the Obama years, let's say.
Also, back in the midterm election of 2018, Justice Democrats ran dozens of candidates, but they had almost no money. These were shoestring budgets, and only AOC got elected. But now there are 10 people affiliated with them in Congress.
Yeah, and so it's a combination, right? Some of these are people who they really discovered and recruited who never would have been involved with politics, right? AOC is one of them. Then there are other people who Justice Democrats didn't recruit out of nowhere, but who they endorsed, like Ayanna Pressley in Massachusetts and Ilhan Omar in Minnesota. And then there are other people who, you know, may or may not be part of the squad, so-called, but they're kind of aligned with the priorities and policies of this cohort, you know, Medicare for All, Green New Deal. And then there's the kind of larger universe of this stuff, right? That is, they're not only talking about, you know, forming a faction that can, you know, cause, you know, bills to get passed in Congress, but they're talking about really, you know, a change of an epical change, a change in political era that, you know, maybe starts with Congress, but kind of goes much broader than that.
One of the other things that fascinated me is that they are not, as you sort of alluded to above, they aren't starry-eyed idealists for the most part. You describe them as the PowerPoint left. And talk about how they are part of the system, but they're pushing it in ways they want it to go.
Yeah, definitely. Really led by, you know, people in their 20s mostly. I think it's, you know, important to point out that these people are, I think, you know, would call themselves radical in many ways. You know, just like, you know, when I spoke to Eric Foner, the great historian of Reconstruction and the Civil War, you know, he compared people like this to the radical Republicans, you know, who were radical, that's in the name. You know, they were outside the mainstream. They were outside the so-called Overton window of their time, and they had a kind of staunch moral certainty about where they thought the country should go. But they did it through the vehicle of politics, right? Thaddeus Stevens was a very powerful member of Congress, and, you know, Charles Sumner and all the others. So
they also
brought
on the Civil War.
Yes, they. I mean, I think one of the analogies here is that, you know, Abraham Lincoln was a moderate Republican, right? He was a member of the party who was willing to do a lot to forestall the Civil War. And the radical members of his party said, that should not be our position. We should not be accommodationist. We should stick to our moral principles, even if it means succumbing to war. Now, I don't think we're on the verge of a civil war, but I do think we're in a very challenging and polarized time. And what Eric Foner and others said to me is that when you're in a time like that, a time of crisis, the people with a clear ideological program have an advantage. They might not have a numerical or financial advantage, but they have the advantage of having clear answers at a time when no one really seems to have clear answers. One thing that I do think is worth remembering is that, you know, there has never been a president who came into office wanting to enact a sweeping, radical, progressive program. There have only been moderates who have been pushed to enact a progressive program.
Including Lincoln.
Including Lincoln, including FDR, including LBJ. I mean, anyone you want to name, I mean, Kennedy, anyone you want to name as, you know, what someone who could even plausibly be a progressive hero really didn't start out that way and only became that way through social pressure and through movements. So part of what the so-called PowerPoint left is trying to do is sort of provide some connective tissue between popular movements, you know, action on the streets and, you know, power in the halls of Congress and in the White House.
So maybe you could talk a little bit more about the Green New Deal, because it's such a good example of how progressivism has developed in the last few years and how you take grassroots activism and then put it into effect through Congress and the presidency, for that matter.
Yeah, I think the Green New Deal is a perfect example of the kind of thing Eric Foner was talking about, where climate change is the existential issue of our time, and no one really has a great solution, right? It seems pretty clear from the science that, you know, market-based tweaks aren't going to get us where we need to go to have a habitable planet, and, you know, the kind of Obama era, you know, all of the above energy strategy, it just seems from the IPCC report and, you know, these other scientific findings, like, that's just not going to get us where we need to go. And so when you have a bunch of, you know, activists in their mid-20s who kind of come out of nowhere and say, well, what we need is this Green New Deal that's going to completely overhaul our economy and our infrastructure and, you know, change everything about how we power our grid and all this stuff, that's exactly the kind of clear, bold ideological vision that, you know, the way politics works, right, is you don't get all of it and you don't get it overnight, but it sets a kind of goalpost and it sets a kind of horizon toward which, you know, people can aspire. And these things are very contingent, right? There was no, you know, preordained strategy that said the Green New Deal is going to be the horizon that people are striving toward. This was just because some people in Sunrise and Justice Democrats and these other groups, you know, settled on a name, settled on a hashtag, and had, you know, newly elected members of office who could push this into the national consciousness. And
including AOC, whom they got elected.
Right. She was really, I mean, and you couldn't have entirely gamed this out, right? That you would know that there would be this, you know, woman who was at that time, I think, a bartender who, you know, would suddenly become one of the most popular and influential legislators in the country who would then become the spokesperson for your movement, right? Nobody could have gamed all that out. But that was, in fact, how it happened. And, you know, she ran on these ideas. She ran on Medicare for All and a Green New Deal. And at the time she was running for them, you know, as I say in the piece, it wasn't, you know, controversial or unpopular. It was off the map. I mean, it wasn't, you know, there was no organized opposition to the Green New Deal. It was just a thing that nobody even knew what she was talking about when she would say that phrase. And then within a span of a few months, it was pretty close to the top of the national political agenda. And now, obviously, some people love it, some people hate it. But the idea of taking these ideas that are sort of way off to the fringes and kind of bringing them into the center of American politics where they can be sort of debated and hotly contested, that doesn't happen every day. That doesn't even happen every decade, right? This is why there's this sense that we're in a larger period of transition and crisis because, you know, huge parts of the agendas of, frankly, both parties are up for grabs right now.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Politicians in their 70s don't normally turn on a dime, and yet Biden is savvy enough. Once it was clear that he would become the nominee, he set up six groups with Bernie Sanders to issue recommendations on the big issues facing the country and the world: climate change, our economy, criminal justice reform, education, healthcare, and immigration. And Sanders is now one of those who thinks, if this trend continues, that Biden really could become the most progressive president since FDR.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think this was a big surprise to people. And look, it's not across the board, right? I mean, you know, in between when I talked to some of these people and when the piece came out, there were, you know, things like the Middle East conflict, which they were very, very skeptical of Biden's response to, I think would be putting it lightly. So it's not like they're in agreement across the board, right? And there are very sharp conflicts between the left wing of the party and the administration. But I do think your point is right, that nobody could have predicted how amenable Biden would be to the left wing of his party. I think now, in retrospect, we can sort of piece together how and why that happened, right? Biden is a coalition builder. He wants to bring everyone in the big tent together and hammer out a deal. And, you know, they told me, you know, Anita Dunn, who's one of his top advisors, she said, you know, when Bernie dropped out of the race, Biden immediately had this idea. You know, he talked to Bernie apparently a couple times on the phone, and they had this idea to, you know, bring their ideologies to the table and try to hammer out a deal. Not because Biden had some kind of personal epiphany where he said, you know, Bernie's been right about everything for the last 30 years or however long he and I have been at loggerheads, but rather because he saw that things were shifting. And he saw that if he wanted to bring along the left-wing voting base and that energy within the party, he had to make that gesture. And, you know, I think some people within the Bernie wing of those talks were kind of skeptical that it might be some kind of political theater, that their ideas might not really be taken that seriously at the table. But, you know, after talking to some of them after these task forces happened, you know, they sort of said, we really felt like, you know, we didn't win everything, but we really felt like our ideas were being taken seriously. I mean, you know, you talk about climate, Varshini Prakash, who was the leader of Sunrise, who was in her 20s. She was on that climate task force that was chaired by John Kerry, and AOC was on that task force as well. And, you know, the first thing John Kerry did in that meeting, apparently, was turn to Varshini and say, okay, you should speak first. You know, you're the youth activist here. You're going to be living with the effects of climate change the longest. You know, why don't you kick off the meeting? Which is, you know, not what she expected. So
it's so smart. It's actually sort of bipartisanship within the Democratic Party.
Absolutely. Well, and that makes sense, right? Because the Democratic Party, you know, one of the political science concepts that I sort of mention in the piece is this idea that American political parties are so-called weak parties, not meaning that the parties are weak or don't have power, but that they're kind of ideologically open to constant contestation, right? So right now in the Democratic Party, you have Elizabeth Warren and you have Jamie Dimon, right? You have Joe Manchin and you have Ed Markey, right? So there isn't a kind of stable party platform that just exists through time. It's open to debate and frankly conflict, and it's constantly shifting. And that's why groups like Justice Democrats, you know, really see this as a kind of factional conflict, not sort of for the sake of conflict, but for the sake of, you know, moving their agenda forward.
And even before Donald Trump was elected, it was clear that both the Republican and the Democratic Party, both parties were fracturing. One of the people you talked to for the piece was Gary Gerstle, who's a professor of American history at the University of Cambridge, who talked about the rise and fall of political orders. And he takes the long view and talked about how political orders rise and fall. Maybe you could just expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, so Gerstle has this basic framework of political orders, and his read of the last 80 years of American politics is that first there was the New Deal order, which obviously coalesced under FDR in the 30s and really changed really basic assumptions about what the state can and should do, right? Really brought about the modern sort of vigorous welfare state. And then the second order in Gerstle's telling is what he calls the neoliberal order, a kind of dismantling of the New Deal order, a kind of assumption that markets know best, that the invisible hand should sort everything out, and that the government should kind of get out of the way of individual autonomy. And, you know, according to this telling, the neoliberal era is the era that essentially prevails through the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. So that even though someone like Obama sort of packages himself as a transformational figure, you know, when you listen to historians like Gerstle tell the story, they basically say, you know, he was a obviously a very talented politician. He was obviously, you know, able to put together a coalition, but they don't see him as, you know, breaking out of the Reagan era and into a new era. There have actually been comments that Obama has made recently that have kind of acknowledged that in some ways, where he says, you know, maybe we took too much of a market-centric approach to many of these problems. You know, maybe we should have gone bigger on the stimulus. Maybe we should have gone bigger on climate. And so I don't think it's, you know, Obama's, you know, personality or Biden's personality really that changes, you know, that marks the difference between how one and the other governed. I think it's the times they find themselves in and where they're pushed by movements and by history. I mean, there are, you know, at the time, 2008 to 2011, there wasn't really a vibrant, robust left wing of the party. People matter enormously, but I think on Gerstle's reading and, you know, these other kind of readings of history, it's the moment that matters more. And so just like, you know, Jimmy Carter was the last president of the New Deal era or the first president of the neoliberal era, you know, there's this sense that Biden could be the first president of the next era in American politics, and it's just a question of what that is. And I think there's a lot of actually kind of a terrifying amount of fluidity, given that the next era could be a kind of populist progressive era, or it could be, frankly, an authoritarian era. I mean, we've seen that with Trump, and those forces haven't gone away. So I don't think we can close the book on that question. I think we will have to live through it and see what happens.
Yeah, and one of the Justice Democrat leaders told you that you know, with Justice Democrats and Sunrise, the starting point is, as you said, if we as a society don't accept the busted logic of anti-government austerity, what would that allow us to do? And then he went on to say, a realignment is such a huge multi-decade project that it's almost hard to imagine what it would look like, much less to feel confident that it will happen. On the other hand, if it doesn't, we're pretty much fucked.
That's what he said. And, you know, again, we've been talking a lot about climate. I think something like that is easiest to see through the lens of climate. You know, when it comes to some other issues, you know, you might say, you know, some people think the way to reduce, you know, poverty is through, you know, government grants. Some people think it's by cutting taxes. You know, you can sort of get into these endless loops of these kind of eternal policy questions. But climate, I think, helps you see it really clearly, right? The idea that if we don't have a massive once-in-a-generation realignment, we're totally fucked. Look at that through the lens of climate, and it kind of makes sense, right? Neither major party has put forward a program on climate that will, as far as I can tell, make the planet habitable in 20 or 30 years, right? It just those solutions are not on the table. So what the people in Sunrise and Justice Democrats say is, well, if nothing in our current political paradigm allows us to live in a habitable planet, then what needs to change is the political paradigm, right? Because the physics isn't going to change. The science isn't going to change. So we need to change ourselves. And, you know, you start to see where this kind of radicalism comes from. It's kind of radicalism, again, in the sense of radical Republicans, not just sort of making noise for its own sake.
Well, and so my final question is about money and specifically dark money. So these scrappy groups are really in their infancy. And as we know, the right wing has been at their work for many decades. And there are mega donors like the Koch brothers and the Mercer and Scaife foundations, which fund think tanks and candidates and grassroots groups of their own. The Federalist Society has been astonishingly successful at getting conservative judges into the courts at every level. You, Andrew, have spent years reporting on the rise of right-wing extremists. What chance do these left-wing activists have in influencing just specifically, let's say, the elections of 2022 and 2024?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And, you know, being an insurgent gives you a certain amount of excitement. It gives you a certain amount of wind at your back, but it's obviously still an underdog position to be in, right? They're still vastly outfunded and sort of outflanked by the larger institutional forces in both parties. I guess what I would say is, you know, the Tea Party was also an insurgent movement that was unexpectedly successful, right? These things can shift very widely in sort of unpredictable directions, but I do think that groups like Justice Democrats and Sunrise will be influential in the next election cycle and in many election cycles to come. I don't think that they'll win all their races. I don't think their strategy is predicated on their winning all their races. They have a kind of high-risk, high-reward strategy. And I guess another addendum I would put on that is, you know, we saw in 2016 and in many other races since then that the campaign that spends more money doesn't always win. So, you know, money is a big deal, but, you know, ideological currents can be a big deal too.
Thank you so much, Andrew. To be continued.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Andrew Moratz is a New Yorker staff writer and the author of Antisocial: Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.